It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Propel Schools began in 2003, not long after legislation was approved to allow for the creation of charter schools in Pennsylvania. Since then, Propel has grown to 13 facilities in the Pittsburgh region. Joining us in studio is the CEO, Superintendent of Propel Schools, Tina Chekin. Tina, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Tina, let's start with one way to improve test scores for all grades is really to start at the beginning, start at the bottom, if you would, to make sure that young children are ready to learn by kindergarten or first grade. What does that look like, readiness at that age?
So, Kevin, we have a new initiative this year, which is a K-2 literacy initiative that we are focusing on ensuring that all students are reading by the end of second grade. It's important for our students to have a strong foundation in literacy.
You began at Propel as a kindergarten teacher in 2003?
I did. I was a kindergarten teacher for about 10 years of my career, and I started in Propel in 2003.
How has the readiness level changed maybe over those 15 years or so, would you say?
It's changed significantly. What we found recently, we have about 50% of our students coming into kindergarten ready, mm-hmm. about 3 years ago. And this year, we only have about 30% of our kids entering into kindergarten ready.
Why the drop? What's your evaluation?
I think it's primarily due to economics. Many of the families within our communities are trying to keep a roof over their head and provide the basic necessities for kids. That means that sometimes there's not access to literacy materials in the home. And as a school system, it's important for us to help fill those gaps.
But haven't the economics always been a factor? People have been poor for a long time. So, I mean, that was just startling to me, that drop over the last few years.
That's absolutely true. For a long time, families have been poor. However, we're just seeing significant changes within our students. And as I said, it's very important for us to create change and fill those gaps so that all of our kids have a strong literacy background.
Has the benchmark changed over time of the readiness and, you know, what you want the youngsters to be at a certain age, at a certain grade level?
Sure. I think it has changed over time. There's a lot more accountability placed on students. For a long time, kindergartens were half day. We have full day kindergarten, and throughout the day, kids are learning sounds, focusing on phonics, and learning how to read. And so it's important that we build that strong foundation.
What are our pre-K programs doing right? What are they doing as their part to get the kids prepared for K and grades 1 and 2 and so on?
Sure. So pre-K is doing a phenomenal job preparing kids, but not all kids go to pre-K. And I think that's very important because when students do not have that opportunity to enter into a preschool or pre-K classroom, then they're missing out on the environmental factors, and they don't have as much access to literacy.
A lot of talk over the years about universal pre-K. Do I assume correctly that you're an advocate for universal pre-K?
100%. I think every child should go to a pre-K classroom.
So if the little ones aren't coming to you as ready to learn as you might hope, what is Propel doing to improve the literacy skills? You mentioned a stronger focus, but specifically, what are you doing now?
Sure. So this year, we've really taken a step back, and we know that we need to make some significant changes. So this year, we've added an instructional literacy specialist to every kindergarten and first grade classroom, and a shared instructional literacy specialist across second grades. Last year, we had 19 instructional literacy specialists, and those instructional specialists worked with students in all grade levels. Now we are strategically placing them in our K-1 and 2 classrooms to provide more individualized, targeted instruction for our students. So this year we have a total of 46 literacy instructional specialists here at Propel.
So you more than doubled that.
We did, and it is going to make a significant difference. So just thinking about a kindergarten teacher, he or she may have 20 students in a classroom, and that teacher needs to teach all students. With the literacy specialist, students will have more individualized time. So every student will have that opportunity every single day to work independently with the instructional literacy specialist.
K to two is a focus because grade three is so important. Why?
So we know what research says. If students aren't reading by third grade, they're four times more likely to drop out of high school. And we want to make sure that we are building a strong foundation and we are changing those outcomes. It's important for every child to know how to read by the time they enter into third grade.
Our guest on The Confluence is Tina Chekin, CEO, Superintendent of Propel Schools. We talked briefly about resources and investments. Governor Tom Wolf said on this program yesterday that he wants greater accountability over Pennsylvania charter schools, that the rules should be more standardized. Do you agree with that?
I think every school needs to have a high level of accountability. When listening to Governor Wolf's proposal, he mentions a lot about accountability. And so how is accountability defined? So it's important to note in his release of the reform, he talked about more accountability for charter schools. I would venture to say that charter schools probably have more accountability than most traditional public schools. We have to comply with PDE regulations.
Department of Education.
The Department of Education. We also have audits by the Bureau of Special Education. We have federal monitorings. And in addition to that, we have oversight by school districts in which we submit a lot of documentation, which is very transparent. We are subject to the right to know request. We do publish all of our board meetings. So I feel that there's a very high level of accountability on charter schools.
The criticism seems to revolve a lot about how taxpayer money is allocated and spent. Charter schools authorized by the districts they're in for Propel, that includes Pittsburgh Public, Montour, Gateway, Woodland Hills, and some others. Those home districts, they're required to transfer their state funding per student to the charter schools. Is that correct? And at Propel, would you say that your costs are as high as the district's costs?
So funding follows the student from the district to our school. We get a little bit less funding and we operate on less in our charter schools.
Okay. But what about your costs? I mean, are they lower, whether it's due to transportation or whether it's due to teacher pay or what?
So we get about 75% of the cost. The district backs out for transportation and other administrative costs. Our salaries are competitive salaries in the beginning when teachers first start with us. Over time, districts tend to have higher salaries than we do. But what we do is we make sure that we're bringing value to the taxpayer's dollar. So the program that we have at Propel is a program that meets the needs of the whole child.
Right. We're talking brick and mortar schools. Should cyber charters with no brick and mortar costs get the same appropriations? Should the same amount follow the student to them?
I can only speak on behalf of brick and mortar charter schools, and charter schools tend to get lumped together, and every charter school is different. And I want to make sure that there's not a one-size-fits-all. And with charter schools, it's important to look at the quality, and every school is different.
There has been some criticism, some negative publicity for some cyber charter schools. That lumping together, does that give all charters maybe a bad name?
It can when all charters are lumped together, and that's important for us to be able to separate ourselves. I think it goes back to accountability, which you mentioned earlier, and it's important for every school to rise to a high standard.
Propel School CEO Tina Chekin is our guest on The Confluence. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, teacher turnover rate is about 16%. That includes teachers quitting the profession and leaving for another opportunity in another district, another state, et cetera. What's your turnover rate, and what are you doing to increase teacher stability?
Sure. Right now, we have about 80% retention for our teachers, and that's really changed over time. 5 years ago, we were closer to 68% retention. So for us, we've taken a proactive approach, and we started a teacher residency program. And that residency program serves two purposes. First, it is to build stronger retention in our schools. We're starting to see a teacher shortage, particularly in math and special education content areas. And then secondly, we want to make sure that we're increasing diversity within our teaching force. About 80% of our students are African-American students, and we want to make sure that we have a teaching force that's more reflective of our students.
Do you have a goal, and by when?
Yes. So over the next 3 years, we would like to increase our diversity to 25% educators of color. 5 years ago, we had about 5% of our educators of color, and today we have 16%. So we've made significant strides, and all due to our teacher residency program.
The teacher residency program, and they have regular teachers as mentors, or what?
So our residents come to us, they have a bachelor's degree, not necessarily in education. We are paying for their certification. We're partnering currently with Point Park University, and they spend a year with us. And in that year, they see from start to finish in a classroom, which is really important. When you think about traditional student teaching, it's 14 weeks long. So we provide a very comprehensive experience for these residents, and it makes a difference whether they stay in the profession or they leave the profession. And we've seen great success with our residency program.
Tina Chekin is the CEO and superintendent of Propel Schools. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. What exactly constitutes the Midwest? Is it a matter of geography or state of mind? And where does Pittsburgh fall? We'll talk to a data journalist about his map of the Midwest. And after only 50% of college-age individuals voted in the last presidential election, professors and students at schools across the country are working to generate more enthusiasm about the 2020 election. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Frank Zappa released an album called Hot Rats 50 years ago and dedicated it to someone named Dweezil. At the time, nobody outside of the Zappa family knew who this Dweezil was, but 50 years on, that certainly changed. Zappa's son, Dweezil, has taken the torch from his dad in recent years as the leader of Zappa Plays Zappa, a rotating cast of musicians that celebrate the work of one of music's most prolific creators. In fact, this year, Dweezil and company are playing the Hot Rats album out on tour. Dweezil Zappa was born 50 years ago today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Fires in the Amazon continue to burn, and that's bad news for many animals, including birds. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. While much of the world watches in horror, acres of rainforest in Brazil are burning as a result of agriculture and development.
Habitat loss is the greatest threat that birds face.
Luke DeGroat is the avian research coordinator at Powdermill Nature Reserve in the Laurel Highlands, where they've banded migrating birds for decades. I asked him if any species we see in our region live in the Amazon.
There's a few that use the primary forest, the rainforest, gray-cheeked thrushes. It's a member of the thrush family, like robins. It's a little bit smaller. It's not one you would probably commonly see. Veeries and maybe one or two other species, blackpoll warblers. They would be spending the winter down there and migrating back through our region and heading north to the tundra in northern Canada.
The blackpoll warbler, I've heard a lot about that bird species. It's having some issues breeding.
Yeah, so both the blackpolls and the gray cheeks, they're getting squeezed on the summer grounds because with climate change, the tundra is turning more into scrub, and so they have to find breeding habitat further and further north.
What time of year do these birds come through?
So they're going to be coming through soon. In September is when we're going to be getting most of both of those species as they return back towards the Amazon for the winter.
So how will the fires there possibly impact them?
If there's less habitat for them to use in the wintering grounds, it can be harder for them to make it through the winter and then potentially return the following spring. Those two species are one of the few that would probably use what we might think of typically as the rainforest, that primary pristine habitat. They will also use secondary forests, and most of our migrants that are coming through will use the forest that is regrowing on the edge of the Amazon. They will travel often in mixed species flocks looking for insects and fruit to eat over the winter.
So there'd be less places for them to look with the fires that are happening there.
Yeah, there certainly could be.
Birds are incredibly mobile. A lot of the animals that are in the Amazon are not going to be able to move as quickly. Talk a little bit about that.
So for migrants, this isn't their breeding habitat, and they're a little more flexible on the wintering grounds. And so they can also use these other areas that might be growing back up. Now, if it's agriculture, then they have very little that they can eat. But they're more adaptable in some ways. The species that are in the Amazon rainforest and the primary forest are well adapted to occupy very narrow habitats. It could be at a particular height in that canopy that they find their best food.
And the tree canopy.
The tree canopy, yeah. And so if they're really well adapted to finding particular food resources. And the Amazon rainforest isn't adapted for succession, for the changeover that we have in North America, because they don't typically have these big fires and then regrow. If that habitat is removed, those bird species simply don't have a place that they can go to because they won't have the same food that they're looking for.
How concerned are you about what's happening in the Amazon?
I'm concerned. It's complicated because in some ways this isn't a new problem. There, you know, certainly was a lot of awareness back in the 80s and 90s. I remember in high school, the Save the Rainforest campaign. Now there's been more interest in developing it. So there's been a tremendous loss. And when you look at it on that big scale, this specific round of fires, I think it's great that it's raising awareness that this is a continuing problem and that it should be addressed.
Luke DeGroat is the avian research coordinator at Powdermill Nature Reserve, which is part of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Where in the world, or rather in the United States, is Pittsburgh? Is it in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, the Midwest? Well, the Midwest. That's what David Montgomery, a data visualization journalist at CityLab, wanted to map. David joins us on the line from Minneapolis. Welcome to the Confluence, David.
Thanks for having me.
So why did you want to find out what area comprises the Midwest?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, or at least an area that a lot of people believe is the Midwest. I've lived in Iowa, Illinois, South Dakota, Minnesota. And growing up and being online in these areas, one thing you discover is that people have very strong feelings about the Midwest and like to argue about it a lot. And the other thing you notice is that there's no one really has any firm answers. It's a very subjective point of view about what counts as the Midwest. So I was watching one of these arguments go on recently and thought, well, maybe I can get some actual data here. So I set up a really simple survey at whatsthemidwest.com, where I basically just asked people to put in the zip code where they live or used to live, and then say whether or not that's in the Midwest. So for most cases, that's really easy. 99% of everyone in Chicago says Chicago's in the Midwest. And only a couple of trolls in New York City said New York City is in the Midwest.
Okay. I saw that. And I also saw, I believe,
Providence, Rhode Island, yes. Providence, Rhode Island showed up on the map because there were two people in Providence, Rhode Island who said it was Midwestern, but there were only 17 people who voted. So it ended up crossing the 10% threshold that I'd set to filter out outliers.
Do you think Midwesterners are possessive, if you would defend their territory? Like, maybe somebody in Chicago says, hold it, Pittsburgh cannot be part of the Midwest, can it?
Absolutely the case. And in particular, what I found is that people from one extreme of the Midwest, or people or one extreme of what they feel is the Midwest, are really skeptical of the Midwesternness of people from the other extreme. So people from the Dakotas and Nebraska really don't think that Ohio or Pittsburgh could possibly be Midwestern. They're in the Eastern time zone, for crying out loud, he'll say. But people from Ohio don't think that the Dakotas are Midwestern. They think that's the Great Plains. That's completely different.
So it's obviously not a clean division along state lines, is it, though?
Well, that's one of the things that people fight about. The U.S. Census Bureau defines states as either Midwestern states or not Midwestern states. But one of the things that you find on the ground is that things often aren't so simple. South Dakota is a good example where I used to live. If you go to eastern South Dakota, to Sioux Falls, it's primarily agricultural. People there came from Iowa and Minnesota. The culture is very similar. It's clearly a very Midwestern feeling place. But if you go to the western half of the state, on the other side of the Missouri River, it's ranch territory, ranching, mining, logging. It's much more libertarian politics out there. In a sense, it's the West, or at least that's how a lot of people in South Dakota feel it. Mm-hmm. Pittsburgh is another one of those places that, obviously Pennsylvania is not a Midwestern state, but is Pittsburgh a Midwestern city? That's a much more interesting question.
So are places such as Western Pennsylvania problem areas, hard to define? You should know that your piece sparked a heated debate in our newsroom.
A lot of newsrooms, apparently, judging by my social media mentions over the past week or so.
So are they hard to define?
One of the big questions, of course, is whether the Midwest is a purely geographic entity. Or whether it's a cultural thing.
Mm.
Can you draw a map of the Midwest based on state lines, rivers, mountains, etc.? Or is being Midwestern sort of how you act and what you believe? In which case, if a bunch of people from Chicago moved to Louisiana, would that be a little pocket of the Midwest? That's one of the things that people disagree on. I intentionally didn't put any preconditions for what people voted on being Midwestern or not. I let people vote purely based on their subjective judgment.
Some of the places isolated as Midwest are kind of surprising. Parts of Texas, Memphis and Chattanooga, both in Tennessee, and even as far west as Montana and Colorado. Are they all correct, or is Midwest more of a state of mind?
Well, one of the interesting things was that you had sort of a gradient flowing out. There's a central area of core Midwest that everyone sort of agreed, 95% of people agreed was Midwestern. Places like Chicago, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Kansas City, Milwaukee. But then around those places, you had sort of a border region of places that were maybe 30 to 50% of people thought it was Midwestern. That includes Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Louisville, Oklahoma City. And then you go beyond that and you get to places where most people say it's not Midwestern, but you have a minority who really thinks it is. So like North Texas is a good example. People think Texas, obviously not Midwestern, but people from Dallas or Amarillo, they're sort of on the plains. Mm-hmm. Some people might argue that maybe they got more in common with Kansas than they do down with Houston, the Gulf Coast.
Our guest on The Confluence is David Montgomery, journalist with CityLab, who has written a story about what areas comprise the Midwest. According to the map on your website, it looks like about 35% of Pittsburgh area residents think that we are part of the Midwest. Were those results a surprise to you?
I don't think so, no. I didn't know exactly where Pittsburgh would end up, but just from the casual debates I've been having over time, it's clear that both people from Pittsburgh and people not from Pittsburgh don't agree on whether Pittsburgh is Midwestern. Some people say that Pittsburgh is where the Midwest begins. One popular definition or shorthand definition of the Midwest I like is the area north of the Missouri and Ohio rivers, which of course is interesting for Pittsburgh because that's literally where the Ohio begins.
Right. And of course, Pittsburgh was the original gateway to the West.
Exactly.
Any sense of why people responded the way they did? Is it people identify with the people, with the Midwesterners, or the geographical aspects?
So I think that the people who say that Pittsburgh is Midwestern, a lot of it, part of it's the geographic. They argue that, it's the Ohio River, it's the gateway to the Midwest, etc. They argue that culturally and economically it has more ties to the cities in Ohio and Indiana and Michigan than it does to Philadelphia. and other East Coast cities. People who say no, one of their arguments comes down to, well, it's in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is one of the original 13 colonies. It's obviously not in the Midwest. other people, you know, argue that, you know, despite all its similarities with Columbus and Cleveland, Pittsburgh also has a lot in common with Philadelphia, and that they argue that culturally it's distinct. Or they say that, you know, it's got some similarities, but you have to draw a line somewhere, and Pittsburgh's on the other side of that line.
Your story is headlined, "We Mapped the Midwest for You, So Stop Arguing." Do you really think that this will settle the dispute, or will this just stir the pot a little more?
I think that headline was, in fact, probably intended to help stir the pot a little bit more. You got to do what you can to get your clicks these days. No, people love to argue about the Midwest, and they're going to continue arguing about it. I was just hoping that I could help people bring a little bit of data to help support their arguments, so the arguments can be a little bit more objective and a little bit less subjective.
You mean facts aren't going to get in the way of a good argument?
Never have, never will.
So, David, remind us, you're on the line from where right now?
I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So is that in the Midwest?
I think it is. A small but very vocal minority of people here have tried to define Minnesota as being its own region called the North. More seriously, you know, some people have argued that the Midwest itself as a concept is too broad and have argued for example, the Great Lakes and the Great Plains as distinct separate regions. Or for the upper Midwest as a region that's Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, the idea that that is distinct enough from the rest that it should be seen as its own area and not as a subset of some broader region.
David Montgomery is a data visualization journalist at CityLab. David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence, part of the Mid-Atlantic, on 90.5 WESA.
Are you a currently enrolled college student looking for an internship? Are you interested in working on Pittsburgh's only local public radio daily news program? 90.5 WESA's The Confluence is looking for interns this semester. Send us an email with your resume, cover letter, and writing samples to hr@pittsburghcommunitybroadcasting.org.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Nearly one in three college-age students voted in 2018, up almost 10 percentage points from the previous midterm election in 2014. Campus groups are gearing up to try to get more students to vote. We're going to talk about what it takes to engage students in the election process with Professor Melanie Blumberg, who directs the California University of Pennsylvania branch of the American Democracy Project. She joins us on the line from campus. Welcome, Mel.
Thank you.
And in studio is Adriana Jurado, a junior political science major at Chatham University, former Campus Vote Project Democracy Fellow, who now works with the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics on Chatham's campus. Welcome, Adriana.
Thank you.
I want to start with, how about an assessment of the level of interest right now among the student body about voting? Mel, let's start with you.
I think that students are interested in the presidential election. You know, we have the municipal election coming up in the beginning of November, and it's difficult to mobilize students. It's difficult to mobilize anyone, you know, or many people to vote in local elections. But I think that they're looking forward to 2020.
Yeah, I think especially in the municipal elections, we saw this effect of students being aware of how politics really starts at a local level. And I think that's starting to continue more into pouring into the 2020 election and how important it is to start getting registered to vote.
The American Democracy Project and the Campus Vote Project, they're separate initiatives, but do they have similar goals, would you say, Mel?
To an extent. The American Democracy Project is not focused solely on voting. The whole mission of the project, which is under the ASCU, the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, and the New York Times, that the mission of the group is to imbue students with an understanding of how important it is to participate in civic life. And the belief is that if you interest students early on, that it will literally carry on through their adult lives.
Adriana, give us an idea. What is a Democracy Fellow, and what was your role?
My role was really to make sure students were, one, registered to vote, and then also that if they were registered to vote, they knew where their polling place was, or they knew that they had to register for an absentee ballot or how they had to get an absentee ballot.
To both of you, and we'll start with Adriana, what types of obstacles stand in the way of students voting? Adriana?
I would say students not wanting to register to vote is one of the biggest obstacles. They don't see a reason to vote. And the second is just logistically, they don't have access to the polls. Yeah, those are the two biggest obstacles. They just logistically can't get to the polls, and they don't have a reason to.
Mel?
You know, one thing, as Adriana was answering your question, thinking about what we do, we distribute nonpartisan voting guides on campus, and they're courtesy of the Campus Election Engagement Project. And that's another national initiative. And so we try to educate students in a nonpartisan way about the candidates, and we also distribute League of Women Voters material, and then we have what we call Campaign Watch, that about every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, we have these forms where we update students on who's running and what the polling is like, what the polls say, and then we field their questions on issues that may be of importance to them. So it's a continual education process.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking to campus voter mobilization advocates, Chatham University student Adriana Jurado and Professor Melanie Blumberg from California University of Pennsylvania about how they encourage students to vote. Mel, what in your experience tends to convince a student to vote, to get excited? What do you think changes their mind to actually take part in the process?
Well, I think that, first of all, the students have to understand that they're stakeholders and that they can make a difference and that the decisions that elected officials make affect them. So that's what you have to do to convince students that it's important to vote.
Adriana, as a Campus Vote Project Democracy Fellow, do you think it was easier to energize your peers because you are a student as well?
Yeah, I definitely think I had some different influence because I could just tell people how easy it is to register and how easy it is to get to the polls, mostly because if you registered on campus, the polls are literally on campus. And a lot of students didn't realize that. So you could walk out of your dorm in your pajamas and just go vote and then go to class. Mm-hmm. And a lot of students didn't realize that.
Mel, so you get students, you encourage them to register, you provide them with information, but is the hardest thing to get them to actually show up and actually cast that vote?
I think voter mobilization is one of the most difficult things. We always, you know, I've worked on coordinated campaigns, we know that registration is the first step. The next thing is getting people to go to the polls. And that's why at our university, it's constant work and to get students excited about voting. And during the 2018 midterm, we had over 20 programs between the beginning of the semester and Election Day. I think that a lot of the difficulty comes again in students who perhaps don't live on campus and they haven't written for their or requested absentee ballots in enough time. We had some of those instances this past midterm, and even though we try to educate students about it, it's still, you know, difficult to do. Chatham having a voting place on campus is really helpful. We don't have one at Cal on campus, but it's just about a block away, and that's why we do the rides to the polls and we do the walks to the polls. We do know statistically that if students can vote, on campus instead of writing for an absentee ballot and voting from their home address, that they're more apt to vote.
So the work that you're doing this fall, is that geared up for the municipals, or is it to get people ready for the 2020 presidential and congressional elections? Adriana, first you.
Personally, I think it's more geared up towards the national, just for people my age, because I think that's how we get people to actually go out and vote. Because I don't think, for students, I don't think they realize the influence they have right now at the local level. And we have to tell them that they need to vote in these elections because it affects the national level.
All right, so getting used to voting.
Yeah, getting used to voting.
Uh-huh. And Mel?
I think that Adriano's right about it. I think that it's a good analysis of trying to get the students excited about voting, and hopefully that it carry over. We also know, though, we're going to have to go through voter registration again, in 2020, because we'll have like a new class of freshmen coming in, and then, of course, our seniors will be graduating, mid-year. So we do have to really work to constantly register students to vote and educate them throughout the entire academic year.
Final question. About 50% of college-age individuals voted in the 2016 presidential election. The overall voter turnout for that election was 61.4%. How do you get the participation level among college students to reflect the national average? And Adriana, we'll start with you.
I think, to go back to my last answer, it affects to make students realize that the voting in the local and state level elections, well, it's as important than voting in the national elections. So I think that's really going to be my personal task leading up to these elections that are coming in November.
And Mel.
Well, I'll give you a number that is somewhat depressing. There's something that's referred to as sustained voting, meaning that people will vote in 10 sequential elections. And we know that that number is only in the teens. And this goes across all age groups. So it's difficult to keep people excited about voting. And then especially when you have college students and even college students who may live away from campus. So there's a lot of factors that go into voter turnout and how you mobilize students and how you keep them interested in voting. And that's one of the reasons that the American Democracy Project is so involved in civic engagement activities, because they believe that if you imbue students with the idea of voting and with the idea of giving back to the community and being participatory, that it will last, throughout their lifetime.
Professor Melanie Blumberg directs the California University of Pennsylvania branch of the American Democracy Project. Adriana Corrado is a junior political science major at Chatham University, former Campus Vote Project Democracy Fellow, and now works with the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Maruca. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.